Imbalance IT Solutions provides a unique consulting approach to transform your organization's data, cybersecurity, and hybrid cloud environments. We would like to welcome you to our podcast series we call The Balancing Act, discussing complex digital transformation. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Hello, listeners out there. This is Ryan O'Halloran, VP of Security Strategy here at Imbalance IT, bringing you episode 5 of the Balancing Act podcast series. Today, we're going to be discussing how to best strike the balance between secure and efficient collaboration practices, which is certainly a challenging topic in the modern workplace. I have here with me special guest Craig Feister to get us all educated. Craig is the Global Vice President of Solutions Engineering at Kiteworks, a FedRAMP authorized private content network that's used to share sensitive data externally with confidence. Craig, good morning. Thanks for joining me. I think we can probably, let's start off here. Tell me a little bit and the listeners a little bit about yourself and Kiteworks' mission and how that relates to the topic.
Yeah, absolutely. Good morning. It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me. In terms of me, I'm a applied mathematics geek. Always loved math, computers, anything around that. First job out of school, I'm a proud alumni of the University of Alabama. Went and worked for a MedMal insurance company. I was an actuary writing across numerous states, risk and reports and everything that would go across in terms of actually, you know, implementing the policies and the capital that's required for those insurance policies. Moved over up to Boston, Massachusetts. I worked for FactSet Research Systems for a decade. I ended up being the vice president of portfolio analysis, managing all the nerds who would look at the largest asset managers and everybody inside of New England in terms of their portfolios, balances. So hedge funds, private wealth, again, the large asset managers. Shared an office with the head of the quant division as well. So as I like to say, you know, the nerds united. It was a great time, you know, diving into numbers and learning how to value companies and talking business. I got out of that and moved over here to Kiteworks today. I've been here for almost 8 years. I started when my kid was 0. He's about to turn 8, so easy math from there. But yes, I've moved into the job to cover the globe here. So vice president of sales engineering. Tend to do whatever the company needs me to do, so stuff like this. But, you know, what I enjoy doing is getting in front of companies, solving problems. Really trying to correlate right technology into business value. And a lot of what we do today, right, is really focused exactly what we're leaning into, right? It's, you know, Kiteworks' mission holistically, our CEO, Jonathan Urone, will tell you, you know, we are really trying to give a bit of security and privacy, most importantly, privacy back to the corporate world on the internet, where a lot of those things have just been left behind over the last 2 decades. And so our goal is really to allow organizations to control, track, and send, like you said, collaborate on information, anything moving in and out of the organization, that's us. But holistically, right, we're going to give those companies a new level of privacy.
Yeah, and you mentioned a problem, and certainly this is one of the most difficult ones, is I think one of the number one areas of overexposure that is just completely blind, or once it leaves the network and you share it externally, that's completely blind, is collaboration. You know, and we collaborate through so many different methods, right? So why do you tell us a little bit, you know, why you think securing content today is so much more difficult to control in those various mediums, you know, and how, where we're falling down, I think, on losing track of the audit, losing control over the files, you know, protecting the data, including from our own service providers. What are some of the challenges that you see most currently?
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll go back a little bit, right, just to give some context to everybody in terms of kind of the macro to micro movement of security and how we're at data at this point, right? But if you go back a couple decades, you know, with the boom of computers and obviously a little bit more than a couple decades, you had this decision as corporate world moved over to digital and digitization. Right, you had this idea of, okay, let's roll in a couple hundred computers into the enterprise. And so now IT staffs and security staffs were forced with the question. It's like, okay, do I go around and I secure every single one of these computers? Or can I just draw a big old circle around the organization, right, and protect them all at once? And so inevitably that simple idea, because it's much more efficient than protecting each individual computer, was to say, hey, let's go ahead and create a corporate firewall, right? And that was obviously a huge boom for the security industry, made people a ton of money. And you, what you look at the evolution of that, right, is you have now coming into play the birth of cloud computing and cloud collaboration. And so inevitably what happens there is you start to say, okay, it's no longer sufficient just to protect the enterprise. At the time, most of this stuff was on-premise, right? And so, you know, rudimentary, right? I'm really summarizing this as much as I can. We move from the, you know, the corporate firewall. Now you have like the next step is the web application firewall, right? Because the idea was corporations got it, but now as we adjust over and everything is hosted individual applications, those
right. Layer 7 and they're becoming publicly available, all the above.
100%. Yeah. So we move a little bit more granular, right? And now it's the application level that we're protecting. And if we look at everything today and we say, all right, great, zero trust, when we define by zero trust, and even Gartner talks about zero trust, everything's at the application level. But the real problem in the birth of AI and the cloud collaboration movement and all of this has taken that application level and say, maybe that's not sufficient, because what we really care about inside these layer 7 OSI applications is the data. And in the last couple of decades, right, we've had this boom of different transfer protocols, different ways to collaborate, right, different applications that allows us to do that, which is great for productivity, right? And productivity inevitably allows the stock market to go up because we have more productivity in the markets and GDP will go up. But what we know to be true through shadow IT and other things, right, is people start to break those practices and we really have no idea in terms of what's going on with an enterprise and their data. Get alone from that, all of these solutions over 20 years, whether it's email data protection, cloud collaboration, managed file transfer, EDRM, content platform services, right? The chat today, I mean, you talk about Teams and Slack, texting, right? All of these things are moving assets, critical assets, whether it's through text strings or actual content themselves. And so to have this massive web of how we work in the world today and actually say, yeah, I have this 100% under control, is a huge question, and it's a huge task for organizations. You know, they say, what is it? The amount of content that is going to be created this year will surpass the total amount of content ever created in history, right?
And when I say yeah, content, I heard that match. And that's incredible, right? So you only imagine as things move on how crazy it really is going to get. You know, you mentioned it's the cloud's fault, more or less, which I agree. But it's enabled us in a lot of ways, but it also, you know, provide such a different surface of attack, right? One of the questions that I get asked a lot is there really even a way to make your cloud, you know, any of these, right? You mentioned how they're all individual, so it's hard to correlate them. It's hard to audit all of them. It's hard to keep track of all of them. It's hard to make use of that data in any constructive way without, you know, bringing that all into some type of data model. But I think that at the very heart of just it moving into the cloud, right? Dropbox, SharePoint, OneDrive, things like that. One of the questions that I think is uncomfortable for the less technical and the technical folks alike is, can the provider themselves access my data? You know, and Microsoft, you know, for instance, has things like customer lockbox, right, where you can lock out their administrators from touching your systems or make it time bound or ephemeral or things like that. To me, it seems like the need for that lockbox type feature, even though we want software as a service usability, is kind of that middle ground we're trying to find. Would you agree?
100%, right? And I mean, that's the gold standard. Now the question just becomes, it gets really hairy when you start looking at the details, right? So when people, especially American software companies, are running a multi-tenant infrastructure, we got to go back a couple of years to the John McCain Defense Act. And so little history drop there, right? So former President Trump, when he came in for his first term, the Republicans had the House, the Senate, and the presidency. And so the first bill that was passed was the budget bill, I believe, or spending bill. Forgive me for the lack of specificity there. But, you know, a couple thousand page document that started his administration. And right before that thing got passed, they stuck 2 pages on the back of it. And it's called the Cloud Act. And that got passed. So this is out there. You can look it up. But what the Cloud Act essentially says, that any government that is within good standing, or we'll call it police departments or whatever it would be, right, says that if the United States is an ally with you and you need information from that, these public companies, these multi-tenant systems, have to actually give you or give the government access to that data if it's a matter of national security or if they're trying to intervene into something for some type of research, right? And the weird thing about it is they don't have to actually have a court order or a subpoena, and you don't have to be aware of it at all as an organization. So companies like Google, like Amazon, right? Any of these big players that have it, like you were mentioning, Box, they actually have this because they have to report it on a semi-annual basis. Now, the key is they don't want people knowing about this, right? So they bury it like six layers deep in the Google searches. You can find it, but it's not easy. And guess what?
When
you
do find it, in the nest.
Those requests through the roof year over year, and it's only going to continue. And so it's this perception of like, I've got my data here, but I'm using a multi-tenant system. And the reality is those companies own that information. They own that space. And you're actually giving them rights to that data, thus allowing them to give it to the government at the same time. So it's really interesting. I'm no lawyer by any means, right? These are just the conversations I'm having with executives that are like, you know, this is kind of a problem to me. I don't want the government snooping in my stuff. And I don't blame them.
Right. Yeah, no, totally. You know, and there's a lot, speaking of the government, right, one of the big topics over the past few years, it's been kind of a slow start, is around NIST 800-171, protecting, you know, government contract information or controlled unclassified information, and making sure that, you know, as you're conducting these contracts with prime contractors, that those things are being cared for. Now with CMMC, you know, being codified, and then next year probably starting to pop up into contracts, it'll be interesting to see, can you do the show back that you've actually implemented these things and be able to do it on demand? I think that's going to be really, really interesting. And it's driving, you know, a lot of concern around managed service providers being in scope, right? It's driving concerns around, you know, whether or not you create an enclave that's private into your environment, right? Or whether you log, you know, opt into something like maybe Microsoft GCC High, right? That's FedRAMP compliant and stuff like that. In my opinion, it seems like, other than like top secret information, that type of data seems to be some of the most difficult to protect. But the issue with that is the same, I think, for all the data, right? Once you send it out, do you know, once it's downloaded, what happened? Do you know what they edited, right? Digital rights management. Do you know what happened if they copied it three times? Can you destroy it if they don't need it anymore? Can you give them access to a temporal, right? All those types of things. Would you say that digital rights management and those types of controls are kind of the keys to handling information like that and actually being successful?
Yeah, right. And this is what we see across the globe, right? With Western allies, there's this push towards managing the multi-tiered supply chain, right? And it becomes a tremendous problem as assets move across the multi-tiered supply chain. How is that secure, to your point, right? And so as we look at the cybersecurity maturity model certification, as you're talking about here domestically, the idea is it comes from the Tomahawk 2 jet fighter, right? And it's basically the CAD-CAM systems and the drawings were stolen from a very low level of the multi-tiered supply chain for the DoD. And the next thing you know, in a couple of years, right, that multi-billion-dollar investment the United States made to make a stealth bomber jet is stolen by the Chinese, and they've replicated it out, right? And it's because, and it's not this company, right? There's Bob's Lugnut Shop in Delaware, right, who made some 16-point bolt that goes on the stealth jet, had the whole CAD-CAM system. And because they couldn't manage moving that type of asset, how do you get that through the supply chain to build the plane, right? And Bob's Lugnut Shop didn't have very good cybersecurity. So what do you know?
Right.
Right? The Chinese went after the low-hanging fruit. You can relate this back to Target, right? Where Target went down to an HVAC company. So this story is as old as time. And I think now Western allies are just kind of opening their eyes and saying, this is a problem. And again, it's not the applications. It's exactly what you said. It's the data. And that's what they care about.
Yeah. Good old fashioned industrial espionage.
Yes.
When it comes to, and you know, now we got AI. So now it gets even more interesting. Hyper-personalization, very close voicings, right? Down to the verbs and nouns people use, the way they sign their name, all these types of things. Do you think AI biases and some of the unique threats are going to make this even more difficult to secure data integrity from alterations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have so many layers of this in terms of like data integrity and what the true information is that's coming and how it works. You can talk about with AI just the bias that could exist, right? There's the whole concept of where I mean, we just take a step back, right? You have HiQ Labs, who is in court and has been in court for a couple of years with LinkedIn and Microsoft, because they were scraping publicly available data off of LinkedIn, right? And they were using that in their models. So they got sued, and you know, they're going back and forth, and they're saying, look, it's publicly available information. I just used a web crawl and I grabbed the information. It's not really an issue. But then at the same time, you think about, all right, Musk has been on stage in some of his conferences, and he was asked, right, is there copywritten data? I think it was a CNBC summit that he was talking to, and they're like, is there copywritten data in these large language models that the huge tech companies are putting up? And he goes, absolutely, right? And then even this week or last week, right, you have Robert Downey Jr. is like, I'm going to sue future executives at media companies for using my likeness, even after I'm dead, because I know it's going to happen, right? He was on with Kara Swisher. And so you know this is happening, right? And so not only do you have the copyright infringement, you have the data that is leaked into these models that need to be sensitive, right? This is the Wild West. And I think what the large companies are doing is saying, look, this is going to get tied up in a court for years. So try me, right? I've got a 5-6 year runway before there's laws, regulations. You try to sue me, it's fine, right? And so you have this copywritten information issue. You have the ability of understanding what could be a poisoned model. You have biases that can be created into it. The content creation will only get larger over time, right? Just as we've been talking about, AI will produce more and more and more. Even for this, right? I'm sitting in ChatGPT, like, summarize this for me to make it easier. It's inevitably in the future, right? Google reported last night. They're openly telling you that search is under fire because of AI. And they know that their core business is in trouble. So this is what we're looking at going forward.
It's unreal. There's this concept of retrieval augmented generation that can help secure AI. Can you tell our listeners what retrieval augmented generation is all about at a high level?
Yeah. So again, very rudimentary, right? There's,
yeah.
If you think about like when we in the public, if you access ChatGPT or Llama or whatever it may be to get a query back, right? There's a query that you input into a chatbot that hits the LLM. You're going to get the information, right? The LLM is trained on trillions of tokens. Tokens are just data sets. Again, it's pieces of content. Now you can pull and get requests back, but even that becomes insufficient for specific type of data, right? So corporates, and we do this ourselves internally, right? You start augmenting the LLM with other databases. And so when you go through a RAG process, what happens is you type the query. Now the query then goes out to a database that you've created and it grabs additional information from that custom query. So for example, we do this internally with like security questionnaires and RFPs, things that my team has to do all the time. So that gives us an additional kind of additive data set. It takes the response, your query, and the response from that data set, then it pushes it down to the LLM to enhance it more, and then you get your response back. So it allows corporations to kind of segment exactly what we're talking about, that sensitive information. Instead of loading it all into the LLM, you can just keep it separate, and then you have management of security of that.
That's a cool, that's kind of a cool idea. So basically, there's a kind of a wrapper or sort of can be a different set of controls that might, you know, maybe impact performance or maybe be stored on a different type of data or something like that. But you're carving that out specifically so that only the data that really needs it, you know, kind of gets sanitized in such a way, if you will. Is that a fair way to kind of describe it?
Totally, right. And you can take that further if you look at a couple of derivatives of that, right? It allows you to keep the information current without loading it into LLMs, right? The thing about these LLMs is they constantly need to be learning. And so any current information you have, you can ensure that it's up to date, right? You inevitably then enhance your end user trust because you're getting better responses back. The developers gain more control. The security company, the security entities gain more control. And at the end of the day, what does it do, right? It allows faster time to market and it keeps the cost lower. So you get a lot of wins when you set it up this way.
Yeah, definitely. Sounds like it. My next question would be around, you know, the future, right? Because now I think we've identified the different mediums that we do collaborate, and we realize we shouldn't be using our email as a file server anymore. We're sharing too many links that are, you know, essentially a passwordless access, you know, to something and things like that. And I think we're going to start to reel those in, and hopefully AI will help us discover those things, because I think the contact frequency with the sensitive data is so much higher, and that's why the risk is so much higher. It's much more difficult, I think, to crawl the data sets when you don't have language models and you can ask these very simple questions and then have it crunch all of that information to generate results that you probably wouldn't have found if you spent hours on it prior. And when I talk about risk management, the contact frequency is so much higher than, for instance, somebody poking through your file server, right, or running a scan or something like that. It's really concerning. And, you know, there's so much benefit, but the data quality that we have and the rights assignment and the permissions and all those other things, it's become like it's do or die kind of at this point. And I'm curious how you think that might change collaboration over the next 5 to 10 years, because this means the end user now is going to have some lower friction way to make sure these things get done and done in the right streams, the right work streams, right? Based on compliance, based on their roles or responsibilities, least privilege, right? We're going to have to start paying a lot more attention to that. So, you know, I'm curious how you think, do you think this concept of sharing secure information and digital rights management is going to become, you know, more not just a commercial thing, but more a part of the daily consumer's life?
Yeah, and it's an interesting dynamic, right? Because what we see is traditional businesses, regulated businesses, like we were talking about, right? If you're in the DoD supply chain, it's a different ballgame. Your brand new tech company probably don't care that much about data privacy in America, right? There's right. a different perspective across the globe. And what we know to be true, right, is what we say earlier, I was mentioning Western allies are kind of following in the same breath in terms of data privacy, right? I mean, here in the United States, I think it's 19 states have current data privacy laws. I think 4 are on the books. Ironically, states like Illinois and New York don't have it. So you get to this perspective of like, all right, we're all kind of getting there. We all know what's kind of happening. But then what you see is like in Europe, everybody has these geolocations requirements. So like data's got to stay in Germany. It's got to stay in Switzerland, right? You start to have this
all the sovereignty. Thing. Yeah.
So when we talk about the data, managing the assets themselves, right? It's exactly what you said. There's core principles that we know today, least privilege access, locations, right? Controllers to have ideas of endpoints and where you are, what you can and can't have. Those are fundamental, right? Because somebody will tell you about, oh, we have homomorphic encryption coming up and all these things that are going to happen. And that's 10 years off.
Quantum.
And in quantum, right? NIST is slowly updating their guidelines as they go. You know, the Chinese are openly talking about, hey, if I can pull data from you, even if it's encrypted, I'm just going to harvest it now and I'll break it later when computing power.
Yes, the harvest now, decrypt later. That's it. That's amazing. So just for our listeners out there, this is a fascinating concept where right now, even though the attackers may not have a method to decrypt this information in its current state, with the power of quantum, they might. So they're basically creating caches and pockets of this stuff so that later on, once they do get their hands on it, they can then take that information and finally have access to it. And I think it's things like that, you know, the future things that where we have some level of proactivity maybe that we could do now, or at least being aware of how much this might pay dividends in the next 5 to 10 years. It's a little bit less commonly known, you know, and I feel like that might, you know, enrich some people's thoughts on just their general practices, you know, how they behave on the internet and, you know, how they check their privacy settings every once in a while because they're clicking through the EULAs without looking at it, you know, like some secondary measure of checks and balances just to, you know, over time start securing all this public information about you that can lead to this private information being stolen, you know?
Totally.
So that's a super interesting, are there other, do you think there's a reality around quantum? Because I know like one of the things right now is, and I know we're getting a little forward thinking, but it's a fun topic. Do you think that moving forward, I know there's like some, you know, some distance sensitivity, right? There's some limitations there right now with quantum. If those were to be figured out, then it can probably lead to more public access. But is it fair to say at first it's still going to kind of be used in a private, kind of a private access context just because of the technology?
Yeah, look, as NIST is making their guidelines and it's coming through, it's happening, right? I can tell you right now, the whole harvest now, break later thing in the Chinese, it's happening. They openly talk about it, right? It's going to be the largest open intellectual property theft in the history of mankind. And So as I was in France not too long ago, we were actually talking with this with one of the large organizations who works with the G20 over there, and they're like, "Well, we have to be quantum safe." Now you get into this whole perspective of what does that mean, right? The entire internet is roughly built on asymmetric encryption, right? And I know that's a broad statement, but asymmetric encryption is the first thing that's going to go down with quantum computing, right? So now you start looking at how the whole internet functions, yet alone the content that you're trying to protect, right? And I think this is where you start to see that, the NIST came out and they recommended four different algorithms for encryption, but really you're looking at symmetric encryption, which is much more difficult for the quantum to break, right? Because the number of iterations, and you can strengthen the keys as you need to as computing power goes up. But this all leads you back, if you tie everything together, right, is it's about control. So you can't have your traditional collaboration in the wind. You can't have EDRM encryption in the wind. It's about managing and maintaining the assets themselves. So as you do need to encrypt things and increase that encryption power to be resistant against quantum, you have to still have that data, right? And so that's, I think, where you start to see data can't leave this country, right? They're not saying can't leave the country. They're saying, look, guys, don't let this stuff just sit out there because it's going to get broken. Let alone the data. I mean, we can talk about the entire models being lifted and stolen, right? And that's a whole nother level where we're talking about trust and understanding and theft and all those things that can go into it, because you take that whole model, I mean, you're off and running once you get it open. All that sensitive information kind of goes back to what we were talking about with the rags, right? And how
That's a
that can be
great
a little,
point. Just the
a little
time,
different. And
to value, even though it's malicious value, is
100%.
crazy accelerated. That is a great point. Man, I would, another, I guess another kind of question I might have for you is knowing that in the future, right, to come, that the data is going to continue to grow heavily. Do you think we'll have any issues continuing to protect this data in private environments just based on cost? Because I know that as we're putting things into the public space, it seems like we want, going back to that lockbox analogy, right? It seems like we kind of want that middle ground, and we're going to stay hybrid to some degree, but we're still going to be cloud managed and try to figure out, how do we get better at that, so at least there's parity between what's on-prem and in the cloud from an insights perspective, from a security perspective. And my hope is also, to your previous point with quantum, is that things like the CMMC, they're causing finally some accredited bodies and some technologists to build a coalition with government. And my hope is, as we start to really do that and invest in that and have, those resources, that it becomes a much broader focus, hopefully a national focus at some point, and not every state a snowflake, like you mentioned, And I'm curious, do you think the data size or the data quantity, because of what they'll need, right? We're not going to have the power and cooling to give everybody a GPU and go crazy, in data centers on large language models. And I doubt that folks are going to be building their own data centers all over the place to do this. So I'm just kind of curious in the interim, what do you think that it'll evolve, hopefully in a way where we're somewhat keeping pace, and we're actually getting the governance administratively around this at some point, finally get there?
So I'm working with a couple companies out of the Midwest in the United States, and they have this they want to digitize this process, what we're talking about, right? And so what they're a manufacturing company. They won't let anybody have access to the CAD/CAM files because that's their sensitive IP, right? They will not send it out under any circumstances. They have it in some secure zone or secure vault, whatever you want to call it. And so even if you're the CEO, they say no, you can't have access to it. So they force people to fly into a location, get on a plane, get an Uber, go to that place, log into a physical terminal where then they can actually have access to the information. And that's the only way they can get it because they are so scared of exactly what we're talking about, right? The size, the velocity, everything going on. And they're just like, under no circumstances is this going to get out, because if it gets out, our entire business is gone. So you have that reality, which I'm sure people are like, that can't be a thing in 2024. And it certainly is. And so you're going to have this timidness in terms of management to move here until they feel like, hey, I can throw my corporate security information in here. It's totally secured. The large files, the management, the velocity of data, people, real security professionals at large companies, these executives, they don't believe it. And so I think it's going to take this wave of trust and seeing like real-time use cases that this is actually a thing. because it is a tremendous ask to for society, let alone individual companies, to try to manage and ensure and go to the board, right? And say, hey, this isn't going to happen. You know, you have responsibilities now. Like you can look at the New York DFS holding CISOs accountable for their infrastructure and how it's put in place. They can go to court and be sued, go to jail, right? You have to tell the market if you're publicly traded, here's my breach within 72 hours. That can immediately impact the stock. You drop 10% tomorrow, right? You just lost billions of dollars. So you see this weird conundrum of we want to do it, but then there's a total hesitancy to actually go there because of the risks that you're describing.
Yeah. And a lot to think about, you know, and going back to lots of problems to solve, right? I know we're at time, Craig. I really appreciate your time today. I think this was extremely useful, and you got me to think, and hopefully our listeners to think a little bit differently about some of these issues and what's to come. You know, I would say that, you know, Imbalance and Kiteworks, if you're having this problem, we can provide thoughtful solutions to help, you know, secure your data wherever it lives, or at the very least help, you know, in our future podcasts and here to educate you on staying safe. Craig, thank you very much for being here. And all listeners out there, you have a great day.
Thanks, Ryan.
Imbalance IT Solutions wants to thank you for listening and invite you to join us for the next episode in our podcast series. Remember, Imbalance IT Solutions can help you transform your business's technology, and we welcome you to reach out to us for more information on our website at imbalanceit.com. See you on the next one.